We come to the seventh presentation in the main 2012 sequence. And as you can tell, the resistances immediately set in with sounds and interruptions. That's because what we're doing runs counter to the natural integral. It's not against it, but it's in a complementarity. We are going in a counterclockwise chirality, whereas nature in its integral goes in a clockwise chirality. One is right-handed, the other is left-handed, not as in good and evil, but as in magnetic chiralities. The two together form a stability of a higher dimension, an equilibria which extends out of the electromagnetic spectrum of the universe into the magneto-electric spectrum of the cosmos. In order to affect this, one needs to not complete the natural cycle, but just before it would complete, it pivots, it turns. It turns in terms of the integral and begins to make its way back as a differential. The Greek word for this turning was metanoia, above the mind. The mind, being psychophysical, must follow the integral cycle. But if it is given a transform, instead of having the continuity of just settling for completion, it has the metanoia and it begins the path of perfection. The perfection leads to that equanimity. And in the ancient Egyptian Book of the Dead, one then becomes able to enter into what was called, in translation, the Hall of Righteousness. And in the Hall of Righteousness, one can then be weighed for your truthfulness of having not let the natural cycle just complete itself and end and close off, but that the metanoia has allowed it to have a continuity which circles back again, not as a cycle, but as an ecology, because each time that it progresses in its dynamic on the counterclockwise, it transforms the natural cycle so that the two eventually come into an equilibrium, the Hall of Righteousness. That Hall of Righteousness equilibria had an action. The action was the weighing of your heart. And the scales were held by a feminine, but the tally was written by ancient Thoth, the original Hermes. Balancing your heart on those scales, the original Libra scales, was an ostrich feather, which was the hieroglyphic symbol for the goddess of truth, Ma'at. And it was not that your heart should be so light that the feather was heavier, or that your heart should be so heavy that the feather was lighter, but that they should balance. That equilibria, then, was the silence that permeates the universe into the cosmos, so that one now breathed eternity. And that was a breath cycle that was not only an inhale-exhale like a piston, but it was the pausing after you inhale and then pausing after you exhale. And those two just fleeting instant pauses were the horizon of the equilibria of the spirit. And it allowed then for the breath in its breathing in and breathing out to be an axial perpendicular. And it gave rise to the fact then that one of the most ancient of all visualities of the feminine is that she holds the plumb bob of that axial equanimity. And the earliest record of that comes from China, from 3000 BC, 5000 years ago. It is Nu Gua who holds the plumb bob. She is able to position the stability of the equilibria, and her complementarity, Fu Shi, holds a carpenter square, which is like an L shape with a crossbar about two-thirds of the way in towards the angle. He is able to build with confidence because her plumb bob is trued, whatever it is that you are building. The highest form of building is to be able to be an architect in terms of your life, which would be living the natural cycle with the ability to reach the metanoia, and then to have the perfection of the counter chirality, so that then you reach that equilibria of the horizon and the Lord of the horizon was the way in which a masculinity was able to align with a femininity holding that upper quality. And she was then the very index of wisdom, and he was the very recipient of that wisdom and become wise. The use of chapter 64 in the Tibetan, in the Egyptian Book of the Dead, is all about the psychostasia, the weighing of the heart, the recording. Later on, about 1,000 years later, when Isis and Osiris became the male-female axiality, the psychostasia also received a refinement. And the refinement was that in between the weighing of the heart and the recording of Thoth, that the feminine recorded the name of he or she whose heart had been weighed on the leaf of a tree. It's called a persea tree. It's a fruit tree from ancient Egypt. And if your name was inscribed on that persea tree, that's what was recorded by Thoth, as well as your equanimity, that it was you who had entered into the equanimity, into the hall of righteousness, into the silence of wisdom, truth. And witnessing that was Osiris seated to witness, like a mitzvah, that this has been accomplished, that you did not just complete your excellence, but you complemented it with the perfection as well. One of the great transforms in history was the transform in India from an emphasis on the Buddha, who was a completion, into vanishing. The ancient word for it in Sanskrit was actually moksha. And that vanishing was characterized by the historical Buddha as whatever needed to be set up has been set up, whatever needed to be taken down has been taken down. And that vanishes the whole complication of having to put up or take down. The transform of that was unbelievable and required a metanoia on a scalar that had not been achieved before. And the transform put something in the ecology of differential consciousness that needed to have the feminine wisdom recorded on the tree of life in your name. And that was the transform of introducing, in between the moksha and the Buddha, a moment before you would complete the moksha, you actually turned. You had a metanoia. And that journey back was the journey of the bodhisattva. That the bodhisattva would not accept moksha until every other sentient being, it was called not the universe or the cosmos, but in the Mahayana it was called the tri-chilicosm, larger than large than large. And so the way of the bodhisattva was the way to bring the perfection woven into what had been almost the completion, so that when the perfection was evident, the completion would be sealed by its complement also simultaneously, instantly, spontaneously, having been accomplished. This, of course, is such a vast endeavor, and there is such a proliferation of sentient beings throughout the universe, that the time scalar, in terms of natural time, can only be complemented by an infinite patience. That infinite patience is able to reach into the zero field out of which the original dimensionality comes, that is, the original movement, which is time. And so the bodhisattva way is best referred to as living time. And the living time is not the vector of a dimension of time, but it's the ongoing infinity that the way of the bodhisattva is able to rainbow. And that's why it's the symbol of the Shared Presence Foundation. The interesting thing for us is that the origins of the Buddhist refinement were in the ancient Vedas. And the earliest recordings of the Vedas are collected in the Rig Veda, 1,080 hymns that are arranged in 10 groups. And in the Vedas, there were several refinements that reselected in new arrangements so that the Rig Veda became, for instance, the Atharva Veda. And this happened a couple of times, so that eventually there were four Vedas, And the center of those four Vedas was to be able to bring the completion, not so much to a metanoia, but back to its original zero field. And the way that this was enacted was the Agni Yoga ritual, where one built on a very special base, fired bricks so that they could withstand the heat, in the shape of a great eagle. And in the Agni Yoga, over many days, one would build the temple of the universe to its symbolic completion. And then at that moment, the return back to the original explosive conflagration was initiated by a sacred fire that burnt everything down to not the ground, as you can tell, it's getting close. It always happens. The quality is that it was not burnt down to the ground, but burnt down to the great fire impervious eagle that was there. And that eagle was something that reoccurs constantly in the world of wisdom. The apostle who was symbolized by the eagle was Saint John. It's interesting to see that the conflagration does not have to happen ritually, that even though yajnas, sacred rituals, sacred bestowing ceremonies, were always offerings to the fire, that you offered the soma, not just for yourself or given to you by the Hotor priest who officiated the Agni Yoga ceremony, but you were able to do this every day at the close of the day to make sure that you were living a holy life. The transform of that kind of yajna was accentuated at the beginning of the 20th century by one of the greatest karma yogis of all time, Mahatma Gandhi. And Gandhi learned it through great struggle because he had been born in Gujarat, which is a peninsula that looks out on the Arabian Sea, the Indian Ocean, in Porbandar. Was married at the age of 14 to Kasturba, who was 13, and then immediately sent off to England to study law, and came back so well prepared that he, with less than a year, was sent off to South Africa to be a lawyer for thousands and thousands of Indians who had migrated for work, for jobs, to South Africa. Gandhi's office was in Durban, outside of Johannesburg. There was a branch, but his main pivot would become Durban. And several times, going back to India to bring his wife and his sons, he eventually had four sons, he met, through reading Tolstoy, whose great seminal book, not War and Peace, but a book entitled The Kingdom of God is Within You. And he read it in company with a Jewish architect from originally East Prussia, who came to South Africa to practice as an architect. And he and Hermann Kallenbach realized that there needed to be a special kind of a sacred bird community, which they then built on land that Kallenbach, very successful architect, bought, and they called it the Phoenix Settlement. The Phoenix would be the higher form of the eagle. In that Phoenix Settlement, utopian commune, they decided to have a deeper distillation, a second transform, and so they had a special part of the Phoenix Settlement set aside, and they called it Tolstoy Farm, where they began to prepare themselves and discovered that there was much more than they had realized that needed to be accomplished and could not be accomplished in the classical way, that the classical karma yoga or hatha yoga or jhana yoga was not enough. There needed to be a raja yoga. And just about that time, one of the great bodhisattvas of India, the last 120 years, who apprenticed himself to an illiterate spiritual genius named Ramakrishna, and he took the name Vivekananda. And he, in 1893, was sent to Chicago in the United States to the World Conference on Religions. And he was lionized because he was able to bring all four yogas, the karma, the hatha, sometimes called bhakti, the jhana, the mind yoga, and the raja together, like the four Vedas. And it was possible then for someone like Gandhi, with the companionship of not just Kallenbach, but a number of persons on Tolstoy Farm in the Phoenix Settlement, just outside of Durban, that he was able to refine that the yajna was not feeding the fire, but the yajna was transforming it to a refining fire. And he called that eventually satyagraha, the holding of truth, so that that holding of truth was like the social expression of the Hall of Righteousness, of the ability to have a whole society participate in the weighing of their hearts, so that they could en masse, as many as could be, that would follow this new yajna, which was a journey in refining their lives by refining their hearts, by holding truth in this very special Plumbob way. And that what would vanish then would be the illusory and delusional ephemeria of a mistaken way of society, of a erroneous culture, of the sense that the individual becomes a culture of their own if they get powerful enough and rich enough and can then command the social milieu to do what they decree. When he went back to India, he was told by the wisest political organizer in India, who had several times visited South Africa and a number of other places in the world, his name was G.K. Gokhale, And he said to the successful Gandhi, now approaching the maturity of a man's life, you do not know India. You know London better than you know anything else. You know South Africa. You know yourself in terms of a London, in terms of South Africa, in terms of what you have been able to accomplish so far, but you do not know India. So you need a wider yajna. You need to take a year and just travel all over India, third class on the railroad, and just witness as many of the 700,000 villages in India as you can. Forget Bombay, Calcutta, Madras, Delhi. India is in the villages. And out of that came the Hindi phrase, village swaraj, freedom from the village level. The refinement of Satyagraha came 3 years after Gandhi was assassinated in 1951. The greatest bodhisattva in India at that time was named Vinoba, Vinoba Bhave. And his original little book, they only made a couple of thousand copies. It's called Bhudan Yajna, Land Gift Yajna, where he, not knowing what to do, now that Gandhi, called Gandhiji, which is the endearment of the spirit of the person, now that he was gone, more and more, one began to realize that the yajna of Gandhi was evaporating, and in its place were the new power people. That Nehru still paid lip service, but he was becoming more and more the president of India, the head of the Indian National Congress, and many other wealthy Indian. And so Vinoba began walking with only pausing when he would get from village to village. He would wake up at about 3 a.m, prepare himself, and then with a lantern, walk to the next village. And by the time of April of 1951, he got towards the south of India, towards Tamil Nadu, and he found that there was a village that only two brothers owned everything. They owned all of the farmland. Everyone else in the entire village was indentured to them, and they had entered into a non-speaking silence, and nothing was going to work because they didn't like each other anymore. So Vinoba, who had that silence aura of the real bodhisattva, said, I want both of you to adopt me as one of your sons. And then I want you to give me my share of your land holdings now, which I will hold in trust for the village. Within that year, when he got back up into Maharashtra province, he had collected almost 20,000 acres of land, and then the Bhudan Yajna became Sarvodaya. The refinement of Satyagraha, truth-holding, to Sarvodaya, service to all. By the time that Vinoba passed away, some 20 years later, two-thirds of the province of Bihar, having more than 100 million people, were under the Sarvodaya program, and all through India, and hardly any of it was reported in any kind of a media whatsoever, because it is a permanent refinement of society into a spiritual conscious dimension. The son of Sir Alfred Lord Tennyson, the great poet of England, Hallam Tennyson, wrote a biography of Vinoba called India's Walking Saint. And it's interesting because one of the last of his walking yajnas was in Pakistan. He always was literally looking like a peasant, but he was a peasant genius. The only book for a long time from the West was published by the Sarvodaya Press, and they hardly ever understood that the Bodhisattva vision, the Satyagraha Sarvodaya history that was being made, was a steadfast wisdom. Actually, the phrase in Sanskrit, sthithipanna darshan, does not mean steadfast wisdom. It means steadfast visioning. It means that one enters into the infinite field of the competent complementarity to the natural field, which has no enumeration. It's a zero field, not a zero point of energy, but the zero field that spontaneously, because there's no space, there's no where, because there's no time yet, there's no when. And so it occurs mysteriously. And as soon as there is time, as an energy, its dynamic blossoms the dimensions of space, so that a steadfast seeing of the vision, the sthithipanna darshan, is the ability to participate in the bodhisattva way. And as we're seeing, that bodhisattva way was ignited by a pivot in Alexandria about 2,000 years ago. The first coming together of it was about 90 AD in a new series of 14 dialogues, like dialogues of Plato, like the dialogue of the Bhagavad Gita. And the 14th of them, of these Hermetica, is called the Asclepius. The Asclepius, because Asclepius is the ancient god of medicine, of healing. The way in which one healed with Asclepius is that you entered into the temple of Asclepius and you slept there to have a dream. And that the temple, being a sacred space, being the hall of righteousness, being the equanimity of the entire natural cycle that has its metanoia already into its complementarity dynamic of differential conscious awakenedness, that dream, whatever came to you, would be the talisman by which you could hold the plumb bob of wisdom and bring out in your life, not in your individuality, but in the higher resonance of your spirit person, and participate in the making of the history dimension, out of which would come a true analytic by which you could really change everything. Science. Let's take a little break. Let's come back to our refining and appreciating. The series is Hermetic Bodhisattvas, and it's taking the West and the East and bringing them together for the first time. Not in terms of a one world, but in terms of a yoga and a yajna that are able to give us resonances of the planet out to include the entire star system, from where we are now just a year or so away from being able to appreciate that there is such a thing as the interstellar medium, which is not a part of our star system, and that it is a kaleidoscopic membrane of vast energies, and those energies occur not because there is some kind of line in space-time, but that the pulse of our sun, the light, the energy from our star, eventually slows down to an equilibrium. And that equilibrium is because the dynamic of the interstellar medium meets the dynamic of our star's energy, and it makes a complex membrane that is visible as a swirling and counter-swirling of energy. We have four satellites, like the four directions, Pioneer 10 and 11, Voyager 1 and 2, that are simultaneously slowing down and coming to that membrane, which is called in astronomy the heliopause. And by about 2015, early 2016, we will be able to indeed behold the size, the shape, the health, the completeness, the wholeness of our entire star system looking out on the interstellar frontier. This is enormous. It's like being able to finally come out of the caves for sacred experiences and to be able for the first time to have sacred spaces above ground. Now we're going to have sacred spaces that are in an interstellar scalar. Experiences of the equanimity of the Hall of Righteousness becoming the entire star system. We're taking for the Hermetica three different translations of the Hermetica. The earliest one was by G.R.S. Mead, and volume two of the three containing the sermons is published in a paperback form, and you can find this on the net for very few dollars. And Mead, George Robert Shaw Mead, Stowe Mead, also has in Dover paperbacks his translation of the Pistis Sophia, and they go together. The three volumes of the Hermetica were subentitled Studies in Hellenistic Gnosis, but they are Hermetic and not Gnostic, and we'll talk about that increasingly over the next couple of weeks. The Pistis Sophia came in the next generation to the Hermetica. They were written in the 90s AD in Alexandria, and the Pistis Sophia comes from about 120s AD, but they came at a time where the copies. We're increasingly, over the next following generation, from the 120s into the 140s AD, increasingly tampered with, so that you began to get modified sacred books so that they had a recursive quality of circling back into myth rather than in dynamically going forth into history, so that the vision, instead of being freed to expand harmonically, expand into the art of spirit person making, expand into the history of science where it's cosmic analyzing, the recursion was a reabsorption so that all of the energy went into complexifying the symbolic structure of the mind, so that the mind came back to become an even more powerful arbiter of what everything meant, of what everything was doing. And the collapse was not just that the hermetic fulcrum began to collapse into the mythologies of Gnosticism, but also into the doctrines of an increasing kind of a Christianity, which began to usurp and leech away the way that originally had been part of the way in which the Hermetica had been generated. The trigger for that came because, as we've talked about, the wide sweep, like the wings of an angelic vision, the far west wing in ancient Britain collapsed into tragedy. And the tragedy came almost exactly at the same time that the Hermetica was being formed, around 90 AD. It took a while, but that collapse into the tragic was part of the dimensions of the way in which the Hermetic was collapsed into the Gnostic and into the doctrinaire Christianity, the churchiness of a power structure that eventually eclipsed and drove the original Hermetica into esoteric undergrounds, back into the caves, that created a tragic yearning in the far west. And it took a while for that to also then, because they are harmonic, to echo in the far east, so that you had the new Mahayana that was a refinement of the old Theravada. You had it split, where it was the Hinayana, those old monks, who followed the small way. We're the new monks. We're following the great way. And then you had the great way begin to splinter and split into various sects. And so that you had this reverberation that by the middle of the second century AD, it was becoming impossible to know what the original way was like. And one of the great seekers in Alexandria in the 150s AD was named Pantaeus, P-A-N-T-A-E-U-S. And he realized that the fount of the original way that contributed mightily to the Hermetica with the ancient Egyptian wisdom, the ancient Greek wisdom, the ancient Jewish wisdom, the new swirling of several centuries, three, four centuries of them together, that he could not find a copy of the Gospel of Matthew that had not been tampered with. And so, being privy to the esoteric lineage that was unbroken, he realized that an original copy of Matthew had been taken to India by St. Thomas in 41 AD. And so he made the extensive preparations and journey and got to South India, where he made a copy of the original Gospel according to Matthew and brought it all the way back to Alexandria and founded what was called the catechetical school, not the training of ministers or the training of priests, but to the maturation of persons to understand that there was, in fact, a man who went through the limitations of all of the closures that were available in the natural cycle, had brought a metanoia through the entire scalar, and had come back all the way through, initiating a series of resonances that would have eventually its harmonic in restoring the equilibrium, the hall of righteousness, whenever those participating would, in their own persons, through their own lives, mature out of the mythic horizon into the kaleidoscopic historical dimension, and be able then to recognize that there is a resonance between the spiritual person art and the cosmic analytic science, and that then the arts and the sciences together as a tandem tuner would be able to allow, like a new axial perpendicular, to retune the history with the vision, to make that horizon now, the Lord of the horizon, no longer a mythological god or goddess, but that it would now be the Lord of history who was real, deeper than permanently, but never not real. This is interesting because the way in which that four quality has a tunability of a pair of pairs, and that the pair of pairs gets paired a third time, and this is how you get the appellation Hermes Trismegistus, thrice greatest. This is an excerpt from volume one of J.R.S. Mead's three volume, Thrice Greatest Hermes. Just a couple of sentences. The nature of this symbolic ogdode is most clearly seen in the inscription of Deir al-Bahari of the time of the 22nd dynasty, which Maspero has lately published. That's Gaston Maspero, brother of Henri Maspero. And he had a huge set on ancient Egypt, about 8 volumes, which I have a set of that, from the 19th century. The Deir el-Bahari was across the Nile River from Thebes. Thebes, with its great temple of Luxor, and as one boated across, seeing the vision of Deir al-Bahari, which was a resurrection temple that was set to be tuned to Thebes and Luxor, and the architectural design of that was engineered and architecturally visioned by Queen Hatshepsut. All of the other pharaohs and royal families were buried on the other side of this mountainous cliff-like ridge, and they were in the Valley of the Kings or the Valley of the Queens, which is where their tombs were. It's Hatshepsut who made it apparent that here is a structure which is able to complement the Old Testament of hieroglyphic wisdom in Egypt, exemplified by Thebes and Luxor, with a New Testament vision. And so Deir al-Bahari, when you first look at it, looks remarkably 21st century. It doesn't have the old architecture of columns so much, holding up something, but it has the widespread of a way which is accessible through the pivotal center of wide staircases that twice go up and deliver you onto a third level. I will try and bring in some architecture of that next week. The 5-volume large folio set of Deir al-Bahari was published by the Egyptian Exploration Fund. I've only been able to ever find 4 of the 5 volumes, but I'll bring one of those in too. Here's the rest of the quote from Meade. In it, in Deir al-Bahari, Osiris Fide says to the Supreme, that is, Osiris metanoing within his refined New Testament quality, I am the one who becomes two. I am the two who becomes 4. I am 4 who becomes 8. And I am the one after that. So also in the first Hermes prayer, in a preceding chapter addressed to Hermes as Agathodaimon, Thoth is he whom the 8 wardens guard. Agatho in Greek is good, daimon is spirit. The good spirit was the second Hermes. Thoth is the first Hermes, Hermes Trismegistus is the third, but the second Hermes, the good spirit, was from the very far south of Egypt, was in fact from Nubia, was in fact from what we understand as Ethiopia. He was the black Hermes. He is the way in which the alchemy began when one learned to work with the initial phase that comes in maturing beyond individuality, and that is a kind of a blackness, a darkness. In Jungian psychology, they call it the shadow, that the first thing that comes up when you realize that your individuality is awesomely brittle, delusionarily infected, illusionarily prone, you get confused, and that confusion was called that darkness. But the good spirit was the one who was able to lead, because the darkness is not dark as opposed to light, but as a complementarity, because this is how the harmonic really does begin, and that the two together, the stars and the darkness of space, really are the cosmos, because they go together. It is a quality which is apparent in the Thanksgiving hymn from the 14th of the Hermetica, the Asclepius, which we talked about a little bit before the break. The name in Latin of the Asclepius is it's the perfect sermon. In Greek, it's the Logos Teleios, T-E-L-E-I-O-S. It means that it is the perfect word, not so much the perfect sermon. Sermo in Latin indeed is a sermon, but it's based upon a language form of rhetorical clearness. Whereas the Logos is not about clearness in an integral rhetorical structure, but about being creative in a poetic, ongoing exploration of possibilities. As Philo said, he witnessed someone in Alexandria who initiated the Logos Cutter, the Sanskrit word for cutter is chedika. And we will get eventually to the great Diamond Sutra, which is the Vajra Chedika Sutra, which has a very interesting quality of metanoia. The first half of the Vajra Chedika of the Diamond Sutra proceeds to a single sentence. Then the rest of the Vajra Chedika reverses it back so that you close the sutra where you began. And it is only the sentence at the exact center that differentiates the forward movement as a clockwise and the counter movement as a counterclockwise, coming back to the same silence of equilibrium. The sentence translates in English as, awaken the mind by not letting it rest on anything. Here's the Thanksgiving hymn from the Asclepius. I have explained each of these matters to you, says Trismegistus, as my human powers availed, and as far as God willed and allowed. It only remains for us to do that. We shall praise God and pray to him, and then turn our attention to the needs of the body, for our minds have been full fed with discourse concerning things divine. Having come forth from the sanctuary, they began their prayers to God, looking south, for that's the direction that one should look at sunset to offer prayers. Just as in the morning, one should look east to offer those dawning prayers. But when they had begun to pray, Asclepius whispered, tell me, Tot, to his fellow pupil, shall we propose to your father that we should add to our prayers as men are wont to do, an offering of incense and perfume. And Trismegistus heard and does not carry on with the prayers, but turns to Asclepius admonishingly. He was much disturbed, and he said, "Hush, hush, Asclepius. It is the height of impiety to think of such a thing with regard to him who alone is good. Such gifts as these are unfit for him, for he is filled with all things that exist and lacks nothing. Let us adore him rather with thanksgiving, for words of praise are the only offering that he accepts." And this is the beginning of that hymn. "We thank thee, O Most High, with heart and soul holy, uplifted to thee. For it is by thy grace alone that we have attained to the light and come to know thee. We thank thee, O thou whose name no man can tell, but whom men honor by the appellation God, because there alone are you master, and blessed by appellation Father, because thou hast shown an act towards all men in all things, loving kindness and affection, such a father feels, sweeter even than a father's, for thou hast bestowed on us mind and speech and knowledge." Mind that is able to go beyond its symbolic structure limitation. The ability not so much to reason, but the original understanding of that is ratioing, proportioning. You can work with a half, you can work with a third, you can work with a fourth, with a fifth, even up to, the original set was up to 10, one-tenth, because this was the original scalar of a musical scale. It's the same limited line held down in the middle so that you get one half and one half. They not only work as the original line in the sense of unity, but the one half and the one half are new ways to express the oneness. And you can do this with two. You have thirds. And when you get to fourths and fifths and the musical scalar of the octave, one begins to have the musical capacity to have ratioing of sound that produces the kind of music that you eventually hear with Mozart and Beethoven, with Brahms and Hovhaannes. You can do it with a five-part scalar, like Chinese music. You can do it with a very complex series of scalars like the Indian ragas, which have 22 different qualities of sound ratioing, so that you get one of the most complex musical capacities of expression on the planet. One that is able to take creatively something that was never in ragas before and work it in and express it. Two of the great musicians of the late 20th century from India, Ravi Shankar and Ali Akbar Khan, both had studied under Ali's father, Ustad Akbar Khan, for about 30 years before they were allowed to go out and play their first concerts, and have played ever since. Ravi Shankar in 1970 at the Monterey Pops Festival in California, produced a Indian raga that was combined with rock music. He called it Dhun, D-H-U-N. And because I had just gone up to Calgary, Alberta, to design a new 16-course educational radical program, and they hadn't finished the 15-acre college building quite yet, I had to give my first three lectures in the city planetarium. And my first three lectures were on my last lectures in San Francisco, Berkeley. I was the American liaison to the Gandhi Peace Foundation for the centenary of Mahatma Gandhi. And I had brought in a 14-reel film called Mahatma that had never been premiered outside of just a small coterie in India. The Indian Council, Bajpayee, and my friend Raghunath were able to coax the Indian government to let the Gandhi Foundation give us the loan of it. And I showed it to 1,000 people in Wheeler Hall in Berkeley and gave a presentation of the Bhagavad Gita in an American reading. And when I went to Calgary, I gave that same beginning Bhagavad Gita San Francisco 60s quality, but with a background of Ravi Shankar's Dhun, and timed it and paced it so that as the lecture finished, there were several hundreds of people in the planetarium. And because it was a planetarium, I had a star show going above everyone and the music playing in the background in my presentation. And when it was over, the director of the planetarium, Siggy, offered me to be the co-director of the planetarium. He said, "There's not a dry seat in the house." In good German style of complimentation. It is something to have, as the hymn says, that with a mind that can apprehend the cosmic analytic and work it in with the other seven dimensions, that one gets a ninth dimension of complementarity where the ratioing, not just the reason or the rational, but the reasoning becomes capable of infinite capability. And the proof of it is that one can have an infinite accuracy between zero and one, or reverse it back between one and zero. And you will get, in a numerical universe, the exact computation that one is looking for, one is calculating for. One is an integral calculus, the other is a differential calculus. And when you have the two, now you have the portal to an infinite number of mathematical transforms. We talked last week about there being more mathematical transforms every year than one could even count. It's unbelievable. And it, not only is there no end in sight, there is no ending whatsoever. The third is knowledge that having come to know thee and found salvation in the light thou givest, we may be filled with gladness. It isn't so much knowledge, which is a gnosis, but it is the beholding, which is a realization that all of this occurs really. So that the hermetic bodhisattvas east, in the middle, and eventually restored back to the far west, gives the scalar by which one can begin to appreciate anew that the energy of time forms of civilization require more and more of the courage of the heart to carry to the next transform harmonic. Just bringing peace to the world is hardly noticeable, even in just a star system. When you get as far as Mars and you look at the Earth, it looks like a pale sapphire star. And when you get beyond Neptune, as JPL, the Jet Propulsion Lab, did, had Voyager 2 turn and focus its widescreen cameras, and in one photograph, all of the stars of all the major planets of our star system are all there in a family portrait. More next week.